from the Moan Broadcast Center at KPCC. This is The Frame. I'm John Horn with you on this very first day of August. On today's show, why a Latino advocacy group is targeting movie studios over representation. Then actress Jordana Spirou volunteered with Foster Youth, was inspired to make a film about what they face. She worked with writer Angelica Wandu, who'd been through the foster care system herself.
I didn't feel it would be very responsible of me to do that on my own without somebody who could speak to those experiences firsthand, you know, by my side.
And we'll meet a young jazz musician who has a very bright future. All that coming right up. The National Hispanic Media Coalition has for many years pressured the TV networks to do a better job of representing Latinos. The group is now turning its attention to the movie studios, in part because Latinos make up 18% of the nation's population, but 24% of movie ticket buyers. The coalition commissioned a poll to ask Latinos about their movie-going habits and about their views on Latino representation in film. They also looked at the hiring practices of the six major studios, and based on that research, yesterday the group announced a boycott of Paramount Pictures, which they determined to have the worst track record of hiring Latinos on both sides of the camera. I spoke today with Alex Nogales. He's the president and chief executive officer of the National Hispanic Media Coalition, and I asked him how they hope Paramount would respond to their call to action.
We, going in, knew that we wanted a memorandum of understanding from them, a statement of principles from both parties that they're going to detail how they're going to overcome their poor performance of Latino hiring. So we went in with the understanding that that's what we wanted to come out with. Not immediately, but over a period of time, a couple of weeks or so, we would come to that understanding. Well, we came out of the meeting feeling that this is going to work. They seem very open to it and so forth. We went back and forth a couple of times, and all of a sudden I get a call from the COO saying, you guys are being too aggressive, and we're not going to work with you. So then we're saying, you know, enough is enough. We were prepared to boycott one of the studios anyway.
I would say that a lot of moviegoers don't know what studio releases a film. So how do you educate your constituency about which studio is releasing which film? Because Paramount right now, which has struggled at the box office, has a huge hit in the latest Mission Impossible film.
You tell them the facts. You go around to city, organization to organization, and you give them the facts. People are not dumb. They're not stupid. They know very well that discrimination exists, and they draw the parallel. They see that missing in action in front of camera, in back of camera, has a direct relationship how Latinos are treated in this country at this time. We are the most vulnerable community, and one talks to the other. If outside of the Latino community, people don't know us, they believe everything this president says. And it's all because of the fact that most people get their information about other people in this country through film and television. So if you're absent, John, you're absent. You're going to get this kind of treatment.
So there's the moral argument that if you want to be fair and just, you will represent the country on screen as it actually appears in the census. And then there's the economic argument. But I'm going to question you about the economic argument because, as we've noted, Latinos are 18% of the U.S. population and 24% of the ticket buyers. So that audience is already going to the movies, even if they're not seeing themselves represented. So what would a studio say? It's like, they're already coming to see our films. Why do we need to change our behavior?
If we change the behavior of our community in terms of don't see the films that are coming down the pike from this particular studio, here's the list of those films to complain about, number one. Number two, write a petition to the top guy at Paramount saying you need to sign a memorandum of understanding with the National Hispanic Media Coalition and the National Latino Media Council, our partners. And that's the only way that we will let up. We won't see your films. We will demonstrate against you. We will participate in any actions that are going to be taken by the NHMC and NLMC.
Paramount said in a statement that under its new leadership team, it is continuing to make progress in its sights, representation in front of and behind the camera in upcoming films such as Dora the Explorer, Instant Family, Bumblebee, and Limited Partners. What do you hope the studio takes away from this conversation, this boycott? How do you hope its behavior changes?
As you know, it's a new leadership over at Paramount. Seems to me that it is really worth their while to sign a memorandum of understanding, because then they've got the goodwill of the entire Latino community. To do otherwise, they are saying, you can do your worst and it doesn't matter. People are going to see our films. Well, they're not going to see their films, because now we've been working for 8 months here talking about the fact throughout the country that we've got to do this because it's reflecting badly on our community nationwide.
Paramount, according to the research, is probably the worst offender, but the other studios aren't exactly succeeding. Have you had conversations with other studios? How are you going to address the systemic problem that is beyond Paramount Pictures?
We wrote a letter to each one of the studios, and they all did the same thing. They passed it down to diversity officers. Look, with all due respect to those people, they don't make the decisions, okay? They don't have a seat at the big table. So for them to take us down to that notch down there, that doesn't work. It's going to be nothing more than conversation, discussion, and no action whatsoever. We want to meet with the top people and get commitments from them through an MOU.
Alex Nogales is the president and chief executive officer of the National Hispanic Media Coalition right here in Pasadena. Alex, thanks for coming in.
Thank you very much, John.
I mentioned a statement that Paramount Pictures issued. Here is more of that statement. Quote, we recently met with the NHMC in a good faith effort to see how we could partner as we further drive Paramount's culture of diversity, inclusion, and belonging. Under our new leadership team, we continue to make progress, including ensuring representation in front of and behind the camera, and welcome the opportunity to build and strengthen relationships with the Latinx creative community further. Coming up, when actress Jordana Spiro volunteered with Foster Youth, she saw stories that needed to be told, and she's done that in her new film, directing Night Comes On. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Jordana Spiro has been a working actress since the 1990s, mainly in TV, with roles on shows like The Good Wife, My Boys, and Ozark. But for years, she also had filmmaking in the back of her mind and the idea for a movie that would eventually become her feature directorial debut. It's called Night Comes On. In 2009, Spiro began the MFA program in filmmaking at Columbia University. She made a couple of short films and continued working on the idea for her feature. It was inspired by the years that she spent volunteering with Foster Youth. But as the story started to come together, she knew that she needed to enlist some help. And that's where Angelica Wandu, the film's co-writer, comes in. The result is a movie about two young Black sisters who've been placed in the foster care system. After being released from juvenile hall, Angel, played by Dominique Fishback, reconnects with her younger sister, Abby, played by Tatum Marilyn Hall. Soon the two head out on a road trip to track down their father. When I spoke with Jordana Spiro and Angelica Wandu about Night Comes On, Jordana explained how the story evolved with Angelica's help.
At the time I had reached out to Angelica, it was a story about a young woman named Angel who gets out of juvie to avenge her mother's death. And at the time, she needed her little brother's help. But the details and the real kind of nuance of the relationships and the experiences that they went through, that was not at all fleshed out. And that was the part that I felt like I just didn't feel very... I didn't feel it would be very responsible of me to do that on my own without somebody who could speak to those experiences firsthand by my side. And so the story had developed from I was volunteering for over 10 years in the foster youth system. And for about three or four of those years, it was at an organization called Peace for Kids, which is an LA-based organization that supports foster youth. And when I went back to Columbia, I'd stayed in touch with the executive director. And so I thought that he might be a good person to link me up with somebody who might be able to speak to that and for whom it might be a win-win situation. Maybe they wanted to write and, you know, told him the story. And he said, well, coincidentally, you have this character, Angel, and I really think you should talk to this young woman named Angelica, who is also a writer and a foster youth advocate. And so that's how we met. And you want to take it from there?
Yeah, at the time I was working a job that I did not have any passion for. And I remember a week before Zaid, my mentor, introduced me to Jordana, I told him I wanted to write and I didn't want to do what I was doing at the time. And so he said, well, I think I know the perfect person for you. She's looking for someone. She's working on a script. So maybe you guys can, you know, get together and work something out. And we had a good meeting. She allowed me the opportunity to write a scene. And after that, we were just like, yeah, this is something that we want to do together.
So this is not a character that we see in any movie, really. A young Black woman who's come out of foster care and her sister who's also been in foster care. So when you think about what that story means in terms of representation and what has been neglected or missed or misrepresented in the past, what were the important things to you about what that experience feels like? Where were the things that you wanted to make sure the story got right that felt truthful and maybe informed a little bit by your own experiences?
For me, you know, some of the things that I loved about Angel, well, first, even let's get to the surface things, her natural hair, her being able to wear her natural hair. And it's very rare that we see Black women on film with the natural hair and embracing it in that way in its natural state. And so I definitely think that that's representative of Black women, you know, to be able to see that character on screen and have her be a lead. I also think that, you know, just showing the human aspect of Angel, you know, not just the anger, but also the things that she's going through, the small details of what she goes through on a daily basis, I think is very representative of, you know, what a lot of women in her position go through, you know, as far as being in the system and just being talked over and people not really caring about her opinion.
You turn 18 in 2 days and I have here a recommendation for your release, but I don't see anyone here with you today, so where will you be staying?
With her girlfriend.
No family members? I understand the mother's deceased and the father?
On his appeal, his murder charge was dropped due to insufficient evidence. But Angel has no contact with him at this time.
Huh. It's the small things, I think, that represent the daily, you know, issues that happen that are always overlooked that add up and become, you know, much bigger. I think that that's very important to represent.
The other thing that I really noticed about the scenes in the foster care homes is that there is a inequality within the homes, that there are some kids who are treated one way and the foster children who are treated another way.
That's a huge thing, I think, that a lot of foster youth can relate to. I know when I was in foster care, my foster mom wouldn't let us sit in the front seat of the car. But I think that it's very complex because when you think about being a foster parent in the system and having a real child, we used to call it a real child, you know, which is represented in the movie, having a real child and then having foster youth in the same house, a lot of times they try to protect the real child's relationship with them, so the child doesn't feel forgotten or pushed in the background, you know. And so think that, not to say that it's a good thing, I think it's horrible, but it's just a really complex thing that happens sometimes.
And Jordana, one of the things that you do in the film is that the characters might notice it, but they don't comment on it. It's for the audience to observe and see where the inequality is. And I'm wondering, as you're thinking about how you're going to depict classism, racism, a lot of those things that are baked into the story, how did you find yourself trying to avoid the minefields that the wrong depiction of that might suggest?
You know, I sweated about that a lot. My very purpose for making this film was to honor the experience and to not by accident, you know, perpetrate any misrepresentations. It was on top of working with Angelica as well. I was, you know, interviewing like hundreds of people and their experiences, and reading a lot, just doing a lot of research. The tricky thing was, because of course both of us care so deeply about this subject matter, it was, you know, wanting to, with all of our passion, portray, you know, so much of what's wrong about it. But at the same time, because we're making a movie, it can't ever become preachy. And so it was always just sort of walking that fine line, because as you said, like, the characters know what their experience is like. They're not going to be educating each other about it. So it was just finding, it was just trying to find those little ways that we could, you know, shoehorn little moments of truth in there.
We're talking with Jordana Spiro, the director and co-writer of Night Comes On, and Angie Wandu, the film's co-writer. I want to play a clip from the beginning of the film. This is Angel talking about her mom.
She used to say that the cars in the night could sound like the ocean. Like the waves, running in and out like the tide. You squeeze your eyes tight enough, you could almost see the sun, smell the salt, feel the sand.
I mean, it's a beautiful scene. She's talking about this kind of magical place as you hear traffic. I mean, it's so removed from the life that she is living. And it's a theme that the film comes back to and revisits in different ways. Was that something that was in the film from its earliest conception? Why was that important to the story?
Well, because Angel is such a tough character, you know, and again, another main reason why I wanted to make this film was because I wanted to show that, you know, it's so easy to judge somebody who walks down the street in a tough way and everything like that. And to see this, that the inside of that person is a real beauty and depth and grace and dignity. And so I wanted these kind of poetic elements to be able to allow us into Angel's experience, that there's this real soft, lovely place that lives inside of her.
It is fair to say that you come from very different backgrounds. Jordana, you're a white woman who grew up in the Upper East Side of New York. Angie, you're a black woman who grew up in foster care. Where would you say, despite those radical differences in the way you grew up, you share the most in common? Where did you find yourselves connecting as people who share the same interests and concerns, even though your upbringings were so different?
For me, I would say that we both have the heart of a storyteller, and I think that that's extremely important. I think that by people telling their story, that's how you connect the most. And so even though we grew up very differently, when she tells her story of who she is and when I tell my story of who I am, there's so many similarities there because we're human, you know? We're human, and most humans want the same things, you know, in life. We want to be fulfilled. We want to have a purpose. We want to, you know, leave a legacy or something behind. I mean, we all connect, you know, in those ways. And so I think that no matter how different your background is, we could all connect through storytelling.
I can't add to that. She said that so beautifully.
Jordana Spiro is the director and co-writer of Night Comes On. Angelica Wandu is the film's co-writer. Jordana and Angie, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Night Comes On is in limited theaters and available through iTunes this Friday. Up next on The Frame, we meet one of the top jazz musicians around who's just a teenager. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Looking forward a bit, next week we'll have an interview with actor John David Washington. He's the star of Spike Lee's upcoming movie, Black Klansman. You're hearing part of that movie's score, which was composed by the great jazz trumpeter Terrence Blanchard. You can find my recent interview with him at theframe.org. And speaking of jazz, 22 of the country's best young musicians are currently participating in the first ever NYO Jazz Program. It's an extension of the National Youth Orchestra. Not only are they studying together, but they also performed last week at Carnegie Hall and are now on tour playing some of the greatest venues in Europe. Anna Abondolo, a recent graduate of Crossroads School for Arts and Sciences in Santa Monica, is one of those young musicians. KPCC's arts education reporter Carla Javier brings us her story.
At a recent rehearsal in the Crossroads Jazz Room, the A-Band takes a crack at Anna Obondolo's newest composition.
Okay, so let's check out Anna's tune.
It's her third as a bassist.
When I wrote this tune, I was kind of thinking I wanted a sweet kind of vibe, but also kind of nostalgic, emotional, and like raw. It was like a reflection of, you know, what has happened in my life, but also looking into the future a little bit.
Which is kind of where she is in life right now. Anna just finished her senior year at Crossroads, and she's looking forward to studying music at the college level in the fall. It's a fitting trajectory for a talented young musician, the daughter of two professional musicians, who's been playing since she was four. Her mom, Josefina Vergara, is the second principal violinist in the Los Angeles Chamber Orchestra and a session musician for TV and movies.
We sort of said, well, you know, in this house, just like other people brush their teeth, you play piano, because it's sort of the foundation to learning how to read music.
So Anna started early, first piano, next she played violin, and then cello. When she got to eighth grade and it was time to choose an instrument to study in school, there was a bit of a problem.
They didn't have an orchestra option.
So she picked up a bass. It wasn't easy. After all, the cello and the bass are tuned differently, and jazz involves a lot more improv than classical. But to everyone's surprise, she liked it.
She's like, I'm not going to, Mom, I can't do classical. I can't do orchestra now. I have to do jazz.
I liked cello, but something about jazz, like, I love. I think I felt a little bit more emotionally connected to, you know, improvising, playing the bass.
That was 5 years ago. Since then, Anna's become quite the accomplished bassist. Her resume of performances and awards spans pages and features big names like the Stanford and Berkeley Jazz Combos and the Monterey Jazz Festival. She even was named one of the Music Center's Spotlight Award Grand Prize finalists last year. For context, other Grand Prize finalists over the years include Misty Copeland and Adam Lambert. And in the fall, Anna's headed off to the New England Conservatory of Music in Boston for college. But before that, she's making a pit stop.
We're going to perform in Carnegie Hall.
Yeah, that Carnegie Hall.
Carnegie Hall is like one of the biggest venues to perform at as a musician. Like, it's just a huge venue. It's pretty historical. It's like a dream come true.
Anna was one of 22 young jazz musicians from around the country who were selected for the Carnegie Hall Wild Music Institute's first ever NYO jazz program, which means not only will she and other young musicians get to perform at the famous music hall, they'll also get to study music together for a few weeks and go on tour, playing venues across Europe. Anna got in by submitting some tapes of her improvising and playing standards and video essays.
The prompt I chose was just like a musician who inspires you. And so I started talking about like one of my favorite musicians and someone I've looked up to. Her name is Esperanza Spalding. She's a bass player. Someone I've been listening to since I started playing the bass.
Anna says she admires Spalding for her musicianship and control of a band. They have something else in common, too. They're both female musicians in what's often considered a male-dominated jazz world. It's hard to find industry-wide stats on this, but at Berklee College of Music, of the 105 jazz composition majors, less than 25% are women. And when I visited Crossroads' top jazz band, Anna was the only female musician in the room. Even at NYO Jazz, just 4 of the 22 students chosen are young women this year.
I've usually been the only girl in many ensembles. Jazz is a very like male-dominated field.
Though Anna thinks that's starting to change. Even at her college, the chair of jazz studies says there are more than twice as many female students in the department as compared to 2 decades ago.
Especially, I think, in terms of like jazz education, there's a lot more emphasis on like trying to get girls into jazz at an early age.
Her high school jazz teacher, Evan Avery, says it's her talent and her drive that made her a strong candidate for the Carnegie Hall program.
She's fierce in her determination to get the music right. And also, she consistently supports others in what they're trying to do artistically.
Anna has ambitious goals for her time at NYO Jazz, like getting more comfortable improvising at jam sessions. That, she says, can be really intimidating, given her classical music background.
Sometimes you don't know the tunes, so you're kind of learning it on the fly. So I think just a lot of these jam session experiences really help me. And I think it's going to prepare me for college and like what's to come.
Her mom says that's something she's noticed since Anna made the switch to jazz.
I admire so much the ability to improvise. I can't imagine I think that's the top.
Anna says she's looking forward to the program, and not just because she'll be spending it studying what she loves, music.
Not only are you like pursuing music at a really high level, but you're also living alone for 5 weeks. So I think that's going to be just nice to kind of gain more independence.
You're going to be doing jazz. You're going to be on the road a lot. So I think it's going to be good and a good experience for her to see what that entails and what it's like to move around from one city to another and how you have to take care of yourself sometimes.
Anna and her mom think the experience will prepare her for college and for what she wants to do afterwards.
I really want to eventually have my own band, be a band leader, play my own compositions, also hopefully play with like some of my heroes who are now like living in New York.
But before all that, Anna Bondolo and the young musicians of NYO Jazz will play Carnegie Hall on July 27th. For The Frame, I'm Carla Javier.
And that will do it for today. I'm John Horn. We'll see you back here tomorrow.